This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. My name is Matthew Jordan, and I am an instructor at McMaster University and a director of the Interact Fellowship. Today, I'm very excited to be speaking with Lee Vinsel and Andrew Russell about their new book, The Innovation Delusion: How Our Obsession with the New Has Disrupted the Work That Matters Most. Lee is a professor in the Department of Science, Technology, and Society at Virginia Tech. Andrew Russell is a professor of history and the dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at SUNY Polytechnic Institute. This book is an argument against the idea that innovation is everything, and in particular against the idea of innovation speak, the language that we use to describe the new and the flashy, often to the neglect or ignoring the important work of maintenance. We're going to talk about what innovation is and isn't, and in particular, we're going to speak a lot about maintenance today. So Lee and Andrew, thank you so much for speaking with me about the book today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
I'd love if you could just start maybe by talking about some of the words. The main two words that I think come up in this book are innovation and maintenance. I'm wondering if you could just start by defining what those words mean to you.
Go for it, Andy.
Sure. Great question to get us all on the same foot, because innovation in particular is one of these words that has a little bit of dogma around it. So it's nice to get to brass tacks. Innovation, we follow a traditional definition found in Joseph Schumpeter's work that distinguishes innovation from invention. Invention as a singular act, innovation as a process of bringing new ideas into fruition. It almost always is signified by profit. So there's a commercial context always with innovation. And it's not always a product. Sometimes it's a process or a way of doing things. And again, that's following Schumpeter's definition. So we're Schumpeterians in that sense. Maintenance is the preservation of existing order. Very simple definition from the dictionary. Again, nothing fancy here from us. So those are the two terms. Those are the two definitions.
And would you say that they are in contrast with each other? Do they butt heads ever? Is there a tension at play between innovation and maintenance? Or can we have the new and flashy, I suppose, at the same time as preserving the existing order?
They're not necessarily in conflict. You know, if you introduce a new thing, say in an automotive system, it might make maintenance worse or harder or damage maintenance in some ways. But there's, on the other hand, there's also innovation in maintenance. So if we look at maintenance practices in industry over the last 100 and 150 years, we can tell many stories about innovation and maintenance, including, you know, that the idea of deferred maintenance was created at some point in the 1920s. Where we do see tension, we argue in the book, is that we also create a distinction between what we call actual innovation, which is what Andy talked about, the process of introducing new things and often making profits from them, and what we call innovation speak, which is the way that we've come to talk and think about technological change and business change in our culture over the last 50 or 60 years. And we argue that innovation speak is, it's unrealistic, that it's become an obsession and leads us to into trouble. And that one of the things that innovation speak does is it distracts us from other essential realities in our world, including maintenance and repair and just keeping things going.
I really loved your introduction to the concept of innovation speak. If I could just read a section from the book directly, this really gave me a giggle. You talk about innovation speak and you give some examples, disruptive innovation, social innovation, impact innovation, change agent, thought leader, disruption, angel investor, entrepreneurship, design thinking, ideation, STEM education, unicorn incubator, startup, regional investment hub, innovation ecosystem, innovation district. A company's described as agile and lean. This is a good example. I mean, this is terminology that will be familiar to anyone in the business or digital technology world or the world of Silicon Valley. This terminology, this innovation speak, you make the argument that this innovation speak is new and was not always present in the history of innovation. You even make the further argument that it's possible that this language of innovation actually came into effect when actual innovation, actual new productive technologies was on the decline. Could you expand a bit more about how this language became so prominent and how it tracks with the actual progress in technological development?
Yeah, I mean, part of the argument here, if your listeners would do like a Google Ngram, so it's a freely available tool on the internet, it's NGRAM, and just put in innovation, what you see is the word innovation coming up after in the post World War II period. There's steep curves in the 60s and 90s when it's especially going up, but now that Ngram used to cut off at 2008, now that it goes up to 2019, we can see that it continues all the way up to the present. It just keeps going up and up. We're talking about innovation more and more. And the reason, one reason why economists and policymakers and others kind of discovered innovation, if we want to put it that way, is that in the late 50s and early 60s, economists were trying to figure out what was creating economic growth. And, you know, what they ended up hypothesizing is that it was technological change or what became known as innovation that was creating growth, basically. Well, now economists have argued, you know, like Robert Gordon and some others have argued that, you know, really deep innovation that affects productivity and output and all these things has like flattened or even maybe even slowed down since about 1970. And it's after 1970 that we really see innovation speak take off in whole new ways and become so central to our culture. So, I mean, there's a tension and an irony there that maybe there's less innovation going on, but we're talking about innovation more and more. So, you know, on one level, what we want to say is like, there's no evidence that all this talking about innovation is actually getting us more innovation.
Right. One feels like it would be unlikely to think of the Wright brothers discussing disrupting the travel industry.
yeah.
And they probably just focused on building, right?
Yeah.
And that's kind of an argument that you make as well, is that maybe the thing that would actually most spur innovation is just people genuinely doing their work, becoming experts in particular domains and doing, you know, building and engineering as we've always known it, instead of focusing on, you know, kind of the incubators or the innovation design thinking or these other kind of programs that have sprung up. And it's also something that I've heard from a number of economists. I think, I forget who, but proposed a thought experiment where you kind of look at your kitchen and go, okay, what in here was invented after 1970? And you look around and you see the fridge and the oven and, I don't know, the laundry machine and the dishwasher and the shelving units and the cooling, you know, thing and the microwave. The microwave was probably the last thing to be invented, the toaster oven. And everything, you know, probably was built or at least conceptually invented before the 1970s.
Yeah.
We've obviously had, you know, improvements, but I guess that kind of is one intuitive way of seeing how maybe it's possible that innovation has slowed down since the 1970s.
Yeah, I mean, what you describe is right, and I think a lot of economists and certainly working professionals would recognize this as the incremental approach to innovation, which is where the real action happens when we're talking about actual innovation. And the buzzwords that you rattled off before, and so much more, you know, that's an edited, pretty concise list. Right, I think, is a consequence of people just trying to force it. You know, it's in this sense, it's a typical case of a business buzzword, where people, when they know that money's at stake, are going to try and fake it until they make it. And so the obvious outcome is just going to be a lot of sloppy thinking, sloppy language. And then it moves into some funny directions, like fear is one thing that we point out in the book. So instead of, you know, people, instead of the innovation experts looking at incrementalism, as you described, they try and just scare people into buying their, buying whatever it is they're selling by saying, you know, only the paranoid survive, like Andy Grove's book, or, you know, you're not keeping up, or China's beating us in the race for AI, whatever it is. So they'll resort to this, you know, language of negativity that I think exposes the underlying fragility.
Well, yeah, I was just, I totally agree with what Andy was just saying. I actually was, your whole kitchen example, I thought was great. And I think that it also gets at the tension between innovation and maintenance, because, you know, what we've done with our fridges and toasters and everything now is we've made them smart. You know, we've made our coffee pots Wi-Fi connected. And what when we talk to appliance repair people, what we've heard is that actually here's a place where innovation has undercut maintenance, because fridges, old fridges, would last like decades. But now what we've introduced is like ice makers and all these gadgets, and those are the first thing to go. Like, you know, appliance repair people are often just going around and repairing the kind of newfangled things that we've put on our appliances that really haven't, you know, I'm not saying I don't like a good ice maker. You know, I like all these things. I like fancy coffee makers. But we just, you know, there's a real tension there between kind of like change just to have something new that appeals to consumers and, you know, and kind of deeper change and how those, you know, superficial changes can actually undermine sustainability and repair and all these things.
Right. One thing that I think that your book did a really phenomenal job of expressing is the difference between tech, as we've come to understand it, as a very limited thing, digital technology, the iPhone, I don't know, Netflix, Facebook. People often use the word tech to refer to that kind of stuff. I don't know, Amazon Echo. But technology as a concept is far, far broader than that very narrow conception. You have an amazing kind of thought experiment where you ask people reading the book, and maybe they can do that listening to this right now, to look around in the building that they're in, or the house that they're in, or the street that they're walking on, and notice the pavement or the scaffolding or the windows or the drywall or concrete, and then maybe some smaller devices, their laptop or iPhone or whatever. And think, you know, which of these would you rather live without? The concrete foundation or the smart toaster, right? So you brilliantly make this point that what we understand to be technology is far broader than just this narrow conception of tech. I'm wondering if you could just speak about, yeah, that misconception. How do you think about what technology means, and why have we been kind of blinded into not recognizing just how vast the space of technology really is?
You know, this might be a place where public conceptions and ideas in the academy have diverged so far that we're seeing actual real confusion come out of it. So Lee and I are both historians of technology, and the whole book is informed by our training in the history of technology, from the systems approach to Thomas Hughes and technological systems in the home from Ruth Schwartz Cowan, to David Edgerton's work on everyday technologies. And so I think what we're seeing when people refer to tech in popular media or whatever it might be, it's ignorance, manifest as shorthand. Because as your example points out, as we say in the book, technology is not just a digital thing. Technology is all the things that humans use to better their existence or to make their existence palatable. And this includes material things and it includes non-material things. And it's, I think, an indication of how impoverished our conceptual categories are right now, that when people think about, when people hear the words technology or innovation, they just think of an iPhone. When, you know, you could think about all the examples you mentioned, from concrete to steel to glass, or different forms of organization, like the hospital mm-hmm. is a technology or the factory is a mm-hmm. technology, that so overwhelm the trite digital devices that mm-hmm. obsess so many people. So, but it really comes from our strong background in the history of technology.
Yeah, those are excellent examples. I mean, I think part of it as well, and maybe you'll agree or disagree with this. This is my intuition, is that we are so used to so many of the technologies you named, the hospital and the factory and steel and concrete and the structures that keep our homes intact, just feel like the state of nature almost to a person born in a wealthy country in the 21st century. This just feels like how life is. But I think that maybe what we don't recognize is that all of these things were innovations. They developed not in a flash of brilliance, but often gradually over the course of years or decades of centuries, and have been able to provide us with the, you know, kind of quality of life that so many of us enjoy and that so many of us strive to have. Whereas tech, so to speak, by virtue of always being innovative or bathed in innovation speak, always must be new, is always kind of the hottest new thing. So it's much easier to understand it as a novelty, whereas everything else, it feels to many of us just like it's baked into part of our society. And what I love about this, you're pointing out of the importance of the maintainers of the role of maintenance, is that it's not just part of the status quo. It requires constant upkeep, and that we really, many of us, are not paying attention to that. Does that idea resonate?
Yeah, that sounds exactly right.
Wonderful. I'm glad my understanding of the argument is sound. I guess this is a time where we can turn to this idea of maintenance. This book project, as I understand it, came from an almost tongue-in-cheek project to talk about people called maintainers. Can you say a little bit about the origins of this research?
Yeah, so it started as a joke. Walter, about 6 years ago now, Walter Isaacson's book, The Innovators, How a Group of Hackers, Geniuses, and Geeks Created the Digital Revolution, came out. And as professional historians, we were annoyed by various parts of it. But I think that really the thing that stuck out was just the focus on everything we've been talking about, on the shiny and new, and kind of in neglecting the background of the mundane things that make up our world. And so Andy sent an email to me and a buddy saying that we should answer that book with another, which would be called The Maintainers, How a Group of Bureaucrats, Standard Engineers, and Introverts Created Technologies That Kind of Work Most of the Time. And really, it just kind of took off from there. So we started, I was a blogger at the time, and we were playing with it on Twitter, and people loved the idea and were encouraging us to go on with it. And then in 2016, we held our first conference, and our essay, Hail the Maintainers, came out. And then it kind of just went viral. It got picked up by The Guardian, Le Monde, and The Atlantic, and all these places. And so it was kind of like, you know, I think of us kind of as like stewards of the joke or something like that, or the fellowship of the joke. Because I think it's, for us, it's been as much about how this idea and joke like do work for other people. You know, that's what we enjoy hearing about is what thoughts other people have when they hear about it. Mm-hmm.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, when I think of The Maintainer, certainly before I read the book, my thoughts were turned to, I think, a book I was read as a child about like the night workers or something like that. That, you know, when everyone else goes to sleep, this kind of group of people comes out and, I don't know, sweeps the streets and cleans the trash and does all this stuff, and then they disappear into the night just as everyone is waking up. That was my initial impression, and you know, it's not that far from the often neglected, underpaid and underappreciated work that you highlight in this book. I guess when returning to this idea of maintenance or the maintainers, how would you describe as a class or group of people? You mentioned introverts, bureaucrats, engineers. How would you describe, the maintainers?
It's a really good question, and I would parse it two ways. In one sense, I would say it's people whose work, paid or unpaid work, contributes to the preservation of any existing order. So under that definition, those night workers, I've got to look up that story because it looks really great. It absolutely makes sense. People who are mechanics, people who are nurses, so they're maintaining health. People who are teachers are maintaining education and sociability in children, all those vocations, as well as unpaid domestic work, whether it's parenting or elder care, whatever it might be. So that's one way to parse it out. And you can kind of think, you can go around in your head and look at different professions and think about who's doing maintenance work and who's not. And there's some interesting empirical questions there. But the second category is that we're all maintainers. All of us, in some aspect of our lives, are doing things that sustain ourselves, at the very least. The most selfish among us at least do that. But then there's also our families, our friends, our households, all that sort of stuff, whether it's cutting the grass or raking the leaves or taking care of food around the house, you know, whatever it might be. So those are the two ways I would parse that. And we found that helpful in doing that, because then people can identify with it more readily. You know, there's not, the maintainers aren't just a group of people who are rendered invisible, who sneak out in the night and make our world livable. It's all of us. It's right. Really all of us.
Yeah. And on that theme of it's all of us, you speak about, you know, we're maintaining our own bodies all the time. You know, every tooth brushing and shower is kind of a fight against, the forces of entropy. You actually use that line quite a lot. It's the fight against entropy. Can you dig into that phrase a little bit? What do you mean by, you know, maintenance is this kind of war against entropy?
I feel like this came from our buddy Dan Holbrook, who's a professor at Marshall. And he did a paper at, I feel like it was Maintainers One, Andy, correct me if I'm wrong, that was on wiping and the history of wiping in industrial contexts. And yeah, I mean, I think it was just like he was looking at videos and all these kinds of historical documents that just showed, you know, basically like cleaning all the work that people had to do to keep industrial stuff clean. And then when you think about it, you know, when you just think about like what is going on at the most basic level, it's just that entropy, you know, we know this through physics and just through, you know, philosophically, that entropy is at work constantly. Everything's falling apart, you know, and at some point our bodies will fall apart too. And so, you know, nothing stays in good working order without intervention. Mm-hmm. And I think at the most basic level, it's important to remember that this is kind of the process that humans are like trying to fight the processes of entropy so that their, you know, their places are livable and usable and, you know, and can keep functioning.
Matthew, your listeners might appreciate the title of Dan's paper, which was Discipline and Polish.
Nice. That's awesome. That's great. You have an example of the book. There's an anecdote of maybe it's a friend of yours, some person you profile who took a trip to Italy and saw the level of care and attention that some workers were putting into maintaining some public infrastructure. And at first they were tempted to laugh it off because it seemed they were working very slowly and taking so much attention to move some amount of rock. And it seemed all quite, I don't know, primitive in a way in its technology, whereas in the United States they had more sophisticated technologies. But they came around to this idea that, you know, these Italian buildings had been around for hundreds of years. This one rock, you know, could have easily been there for 2,000 years and gained some. It seemed like that these Italians, or maybe Europeans more broadly, had some sort of more respect for, you know, systems that or buildings or infrastructure that was built to last. Whereas in the United States, we, I don't know, have a culture of that tends more towards the disposable or the new. Is there a transatlantic divide here? Is it is this an American phenomenon, this, you know, neglect of maintenance, or what's happening there culturally?
A couple days ago, we did an Ask Me Anything segment on Reddit when someone was really pushing us on the point of, aren't you just criticizing capitalism? And to what extent is this an American thing or not? And it's an interesting question, and I'm not sure we have a real answer other than to say we're not comfortable identifying this solely as an American affliction. Because we see examples all over the world, whether it's in Brazil or in the Netherlands, you know, we give them a lot of credit in the book, and it's credit that they deserve for their water management. But even the Dutch have fallen down a little bit. And there's been a recent example of a canal collapse in Amsterdam. There's a lot of deferred maintenance there. So I'm not sure I could get on board with a simple transatlantic explanation, but I think what the example that you were describing about the stones in Italy draws out is the point about long-term thinking. And I do think it's truer in the U.S. than in other places that we're not so good at long-term thinking for a variety of reasons. But I think that's definitely something worth highlighting, and we play it up quite a bit in our book on individual levels as well as societal levels. But I know Lee has thoughts on this too.
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree with what you just said. I was just thinking that, Andy, we have a buddy, Phil Scranton, the historian of business and technology, who sends us selected documents he's found. He's literally looking at business all over the globe right now and has been looking at Eastern Europe recently. And I can't remember where it was. It might have been in Poland in like the 50s and 60s. And, you know, there were the Polish people were resisting what they saw as the Americanization of housing, where the Americans built houses to last like 20 years. And this was like like just completely opposite of the culture, which was when you built a building, you built it to last. So I think there's some pretty deep cultural things going on here that might have to do with like capitalism and cheapness of resources and products and these kinds of things. But I don't think we have a really great feel for how far it reaches yet.
Yeah, that's interesting. I see the temptation to resist, you know, bringing everything down to the pathology of capitalism or America, because that feels a bit too easy. And I appreciate the will to kind of resist that, even though there are definitely like different cross-cultural forces at play. I'm wondering if you could say a little bit about just the economic toll that deferred maintenance can take. You have examples about the subway metro system in Washington and New York and how much housing repair costs and fixing trains. Those are just some examples that come to mind. I don't know if you have favorite examples or go-to examples of just how costly it can be when systems go unmaintained for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like the big metro systems, subway systems, you're talking about like billions of dollars of deferred maintenance. And then at the national level, you know, I've seen estimates from the American Society of Civil Engineers that we're really talking about like trillions of dollars of deferred infrastructure maintenance at that level. There is an example that I like to use to kind of show people, you know, how there's economic costs that aren't just about the cost of maintenance, but bad maintenance leads to other kinds of economic costs.
Right.
Which is that, like, if we think about productivity gains over the last 200 years or whatever, it's really about adopting new technologies and ways of doing things that increase output and allow us to do things faster and easier. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, if you think about the railroad system is a great example, that's, you know, we've gotten huge benefits from rail and being able to move things around cheaply, you know, including things we bring in from China or whatever at this point. But, you know, there are parts of the railroad system where we actually have to drive slower over the rails than they were originally designed for, right? Just because we've taken such bad examples of them. So, I mean, this is the kind of example, and I think we could look at many other places in industry and, you know, infrastructure where this is true, where, you know, you can introduce a technology that will give you a benefit, but if you don't take care of it adequately, you actually lose some of that game, right? So you can actually lose growth. And I think that's a pretty important point.
Yeah, I mean, it was fairly stark and somewhat disturbing with some of these examples just to see the toll of deferred maintenance, right? And I was even driving home this morning and looking around me, you know, I start to notice, I don't know if this is an affliction that you guys have felt doing this research over the past 5 years, but you kind of start to see it everywhere. Once you start to look at the world through the lens of, you know, maintenance, you see the signs that are crumbling and the parts of the road and the potholes that are unfilled and the, I don't know, restaurants that need painting and all of just the little things that we let slip through the cracks, not to mention the cleaning of one's own bedroom that you can easily succumb to the forces of entropy if left unmatched. Do you feel like part of your goal here is to kind of help people put on a new set of spectacles and see the world through kind of the eyes of maintenance and the maintainers in that way?
Yeah, that's a really nice way to put it. It's great if people do that. And you're right, we've both been afflicted with the same goggles over the past few years. And these are choices, you know. Things do fall apart naturally. That's entropy. But in the situations that you're describing, people are making choices not to keep things up. And that's pretty important, because what we want at the end of the day is to write a book that makes people reconsider those choices and the cost of those choices. So if it's a city not taking care of a pothole, it's individual drivers who have to fix their suspension or flat tire, you know, so it distributes those costs. And I think people who are in a position to do something about that have some obligation to do that, not only because it's the right thing to do, but because it can help other people.
One thing that I really, really shocked me to learn is that one of the biggest barriers to the widespread adoption of self-driving cars is not, you know, powerful enough visual recognition AI systems, but just terrible roads. And if, you know, if the roads were flat and the signs were well maintained, we'd have self-driving cars on the roads. But the mere fact that, you know, society that so many of our cities have allowed this infrastructure to crumble makes it basically impossible for any, you know, any computer to be able to analyze what's going on when a stop sign, you know, has graffiti on it and roads haven't been paved in decades or that kind of thing, which I think probably fits into this argument that we are, you know, it's this nice contrast of this new innovation. You know, the self-driving car is kind of this, you know, profound dream of Silicon Valley, whereas the problem probably most in need of solving is just cracks in the road, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's a beautiful example. I actually have friends who are professors who work on transportation issues, and, you know, they're kind of lukewarm on self-driving cars. They're like, I don't know if, you know, they're so great. But, you know, the one thing is that, you know, this is what they tell me. They're like, the one thing is that if we really wanted them to work, we'd have to, like, massively, like, up, you know, like, repair and maintain the roads. So, like, it would be a huge benefit from that direction. Yeah.
We get the same feeling when we hear about Elon Musk and his whatever he's calling his version of subways. You know, let's say you can build those and let's say that they work. And this kind of goes to your first question, Matthew. They'll need to be maintained. So an innovation that's not maintained is just garbage. It's a failure. So it's, you know, even the new stuff, the fantasy stuff with no maintenance plan is destined to fail. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I want to draw our attention now to the digital realm. We've been talking a lot about physical technologies, roads and buildings and subway systems and railways. But I think one really underappreciated realm where an immense amount of maintenance work goes on is in the realm of digital technology itself. Just speaking from personal experience, I know that I have friends who are data scientists. The word scientist there is maybe a bit of a misnomer. Data maintainer, data code janitor is probably a more effective type of title, right? These are custodians of grids of numbers, essentially. There are people who are required to, you know, every time you flag, I don't know, inappropriate content on a website, a human being has to be on the other end of that, keeping that, you know, dredging through the worst of our comment sections, making sure everything is maintained in some way. Even the physical infrastructure of the internet must be maintained. And that was something that I really started thinking about in the pandemic, because it seemed that, you know, in March, when most of at least the world around me in Toronto shut down, the internet was remaining afloat. And I was thinking, well, how is this possible if everyone is at home, that the internet is still chugging along? And it made me really appreciate the people who are responsible for the maintenance of the servers and the wires and the undersea cables that make all of this possible. I don't know if I have a question at the end of this as much as expressing my appreciation for you for drawing the attention to this, or if there's anything I've missed in the digital realm where maintenance still is paramount, but it's even probably harder to see because, you know, we're not driving over the cracked pavement roads when we use the internet.
I do think there's something about maintenance in the digital realm that really bears drawing out a little bit more, which is to say that it's the perceptions that we get about, you know, all the stuff we were talking about in the first part of the interview about innovation in Silicon Valley and the flashiness of all that. Anybody who knows anything in that world knows that profitability doesn't come from the flashiness. If a company actually wants to make profit over the long term, it comes from reliability and maintenance and uptime. So companies like Netflix and Amazon and Oracle and your internet service providers and the hardware providers, for that matter, like Apple or Dell or Lenovo or whomever, Their reputation and their money comes from working, you know, and staying working. But the public image is something different. It's of, you know, Steve Jobs on stage in his turtleneck or flashy new features or whatever it might be. And so they're playing a funny game there, these digital companies, because they're making money on the one hand, but projecting an image on the other hand that doesn't really align with the truth in their companies.
One example that makes me think of is in artificial intelligence. So many AI systems rely on labeled images of the things that they are trying to do. So if it's a system that recognizes images of dogs, you need to feed it many images of dogs labeled. And human beings have to do that labeling, of course. So there are services like Amazon Mechanical Turk or companies that will hire, very low wage labor in other countries that are not the countries that deploy the technology to do this labeling work. And it, you know, something like 80 to 90% of all the work that goes into any AI project is in the data labeling, the data maintenance, the code janitoring. And then finally, the last, 10 to 15% is quote unquote the AI, the part that Elon Musk or Steve Jobs or Mark Zuckerberg would recognize as, or that we would recognize the work as those people's companies do, in AI. But the rest of it is kind of that unseen maintenance work. That was just one other example that I thought of in the digital realm. So yes, it's kind of backwards in what we think, a lot of these companies are actually doing. Maybe we can speak a bit about the status of the social status of the, maintainers. Obviously the innovators, the inventors get a lot of clout, a lot of money, a lot of credit. Can you say a little bit about the maintainers, their role in society, in terms of economically, as a matter of class? Why have we decided that the people most necessary for the maintenance of our crucial technologies are not, appropriately compensated economically or in status in the way we live?
Yeah, so I mean, there's a little bit of a paradox, like you say, because it's the people who really keep things going. And on the one hand, in some areas, they are well compensated. Whether it's some advanced tradesmen, or I'm sure that the vice presidents for operations and logistics at some large companies are well compensated. But for the most part, I think as we've seen, especially in the pandemic, the quote unquote essential workers are not well compensated. There's data that we talk about in the book that comes by way of United Way's ALICE project that shows that some huge percentage of American households don't make enough to make ends meet in what Alice calls a basic household budget. I think it's at least 40% off the top of my head. And many of the people who are full-time workers in that group are working in the jobs that we would describe as maintenance jobs, to your earlier question. So, part of the why is that the case is the real question, and how can this be? And part of it is just good old-fashioned snobbery and status right. politics that's not unique to the United States. Mm-hmm. It's actually more pernicious in other parts of the world in the form of caste structures. Mm-hmm. America supposedly has a lot more class mobility, even though I think a lot of the people we call maintainers wouldn't say that mm-hmm. that's true. And it goes all the way from compensation for people who, like I said, now are heroes as essential workers, but in normal times are just ignored, to during their careers, to what we teach children about what's important in those roles. And your story about the book, Matthew, was right on point. It's someone who's basically invisible. Get out of my way, do your job, get out of my way. I don't want to have to think about you. And so it shows up in status and it shows up in compensation.
No, I think the only thing I would add is that we know from, studies in social science going way back to the 20s that status hierarchies are real. And that, when people just rank jobs, maintainers' jobs tend to fall to the bottom. You know, and I think it's, you know, we're taught by our parents and teachers and everyone else we interact with in our culture where jobs fit in the kind of ladder of statuses, you know. So, I mean, that's a really, when you think about that, that's a really deep cultural structure. And, you know, it's part of what we're trying to do in the book is just highlight it and say, you know, we should look at the world in a different way and kind of put more value on these maintenance roles. But it's a very, very deep structure, an old structure.
And it's no coincidence, we should add, again, as we put out in the book, that the people who bear the brunt of this injustice are the people who have historically been discriminated against, whether it's ethnic and racial minorities or women or the cross-section of both. Those populations really suffer from the status and compensation issues that we're talking about.
Right. And in particular, I mean, you have a good section when you speak about the maintenance in the home as well, right? This is not just about jobs, you know, paid jobs, but equally about a lot of unpaid labor that goes very much unacknowledged too.
Yeah. And, you know, we know from studies, I mean, this is very well known, but studies of homework that it falls, you know, it falls on women's shoulders much more than men. And, you know, and, you know, caring for elders and children and all that kind of maintenance and care work is mostly done by women, too. So there's definitely inequalities when it comes to these issues.
Right. One thing that really struck me is when you were speaking about philanthropic and edtech, educational technology investment into schools, and that very little of this investment goes into maintenance work, right? It's all about how can we get the new flashiest, I don't know, laptops or technologies or, I don't know, systems of education or the new curriculum. And very rarely is it about, okay, are the pipes working? And is the water clean? And do the lockers work? And are the floors flat? You know, are the floors straight? And is the seesaw, you know, is the teeter-totter safe? Which leads me to think about both myself and a lot of my colleagues. I work in academia as a history of science instructor, but I also work in / adjacent to the tech industry, where I know many people who are very hardworking, interested in questions of engineering, using technology to improve human well-being. These aren't necessarily people, you know, these aren't profit-hungry people who want to exploit anyone, but they are attracted to the idea of using technology, in particular digital technology, to improve people's lives, and might be hard to reach through this argument of, well, the best thing you could do for, you know, schools is nothing to do with a tablet, but everything to do with, you know, the screws and nails on the desks or the physical state of the textbooks. I'm wondering where does that balance lie for you? What is, you know, what is the optimal kind of balance to strike between thinking about innovation, thinking about the future technology that we might build on the one hand, and on the other, you know, keeping up to speed, up to date, up to working condition, the technology we already do have?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, it's easy to make fun of ed tech because there's so many, it's like a long history of failures in some respects, you know. I ended a talk at an ed tech conference with a picture of like e-waste just piled high. And I was just right. Like, this is the history of ed tech here in a photo. But I'm not like, you know, I am among other things these COVID days a homeschool teacher. And I use ed tech with my children. I use a math game called Dreambox with them. And I use Khan Academy, the Khan Academy app, with my kids. And I think ed tech's great in, you know, in its context. I don't think it's a fix-all. I think you still need really great teachers working one-on-one with children and such. But, you know, there's something to it. But I think that, you know, our spin on this question would be, okay, it's true that, you know, the American Society of Civil Engineers gives American schools like a D or a D plus, okay, in terms of their infrastructure report card. And a lot of that has to do with crumbling physical infrastructure. It's not about tablets yet. And yet, I think when we look at the history of ed tech systems, especially in the last, 5 to 10 years, and especially even around famous things like one laptop per child, a lot of these programs are specifically falling down because of maintenance, right? Like they don't know how to maintain these tablets, and they don't have good maintenance projects. And God, you are handing these things to children, for Christ's sake, right? Who do all kinds of things, like pour soda into them or whatever. And so I think it's about, even if you want to focus on the new thing, and it's fine to do that, you have to think about how you are going to keep that thing going over the long haul. And I just think, there's so little of that thinking so often in ed tech and other kind of digital spaces. And you see it because, the one laptop per child and other such things really fell down around maintenance. They really hadn't thought through those problems enough. So, I mean, that's one angle on the topic. Andy might have other thoughts.
Yeah, I think that's 100% right. And I hope that people who are reading our book or hearing about our book are thinking more seriously about designing, not just for the sake of designing, but designing to meet what they and others might think of as virtuous social ends. And so if you're helping a child learn and you're making a product that's built to last, and if you've done any of that because of the book that we've written, then I'd be really happy. I think I'd be happier if I heard that people who are voting on their local school budgets or for local or state or national political office are voting for people who they think have those values in mind better. And so I'm not worried about the supply of gadgets coming into my kid's school, but I'm worried about what Lee mentioned that the American Society of Civil Engineers is worried about. I'm worried about, the ceiling caving in or the walkway crumbling and someone tripping on it and getting hurt. That's what people need to realize that is the most important technology in their community. That's the message that I hope people get out of the book.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I'm reminded as you were speaking, we were talking a few minutes ago about digital technology maintenance. There was a book I read recently by Nadia Egbal who took a real anthropological lens on open source code and the people responsible for basically the maintenance of the vast majority of the software that exists in the world is open source. And so anyone can contribute to it, anyone can edit it, but it often falls in the hands of small groups of extraordinarily hardworking and often not at all compensated people to do that maintenance work. What I love about this book that you've written is that it encompasses everything from that to the roads, to the schools, to our own bodies, our families, our houses, our planet, environmental sustainability. I think that the book is interesting because it does not explicitly say, here is what you need to do about it. At the end, you have a call, an invitation to join the community, the maintainers, a website, a mailing list, and to start asking these neglected questions as we've been doing in this interview. So I hope that to anyone listening to this conversation, and hopefully if you read this book, invites you to start a conversation with the people around you to make sure that this is top of mind. Because I will say once you get into the mindset of the importance of maintenance, it's hard to stop. So where should the listeners go if they want more information about you guys, if they want to buy the book, if they want to regularly think about the maintainers?
Yeah, the easiest thing to do is go to themaintainers.org. You need to put the in front of maintainers or you get somebody else. And you can sign up for our email listserv there. I'm at STS_news on Twitter. Andy's at Russell Prof. And, you can also find our emails in various places, including on the maintainers list. And yeah, totally reach out to the community and reach out to us individually. We love talking to people about these ideas and thinking about ways to collaborate.
And it is a fun community. And eclectic's the word, kind of like what you were getting at, Matthew, because these things touch every imaginable aspect of our lives. everything's on the table. So it's just a matter of having a fun and respectful conversation and trying to inspire other people to do the same.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for speaking with me today. The book is The Innovation Delusion. Lee Vinsel and Andrew Russell, thank you again.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.